little bit about those stories on which the Christians base their faith. They're called the Gospels, and we all know there are four of them: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. In my innocence as a child, I imagined they were four of his disciples. Of course, anyone who's ever actually read the Bible would know that that's not the case. However, two of them allegedly are his disciples. The two others are companions of Paul. But we now know that this idea that they were early eyewitnesses is unsustainable. If we look at the so-called synoptic gospels, that's the three that appear very similar, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, we discover, in fact, that the core story originates from Mark. Mark is the first of the Gospels, even though it doesn't appear as the earliest of the Gospels. Now, Mark is reproduced in great detail and word for word in the Gospels of Matthew and Luke. Now, there's something very curious about that. Matthew is supposedly one of the 12 disciples and was a witness to much that had happened with Jesus. Why would it be the case that Matthew copies the testimony of Mark, who was not a witness? Are we understanding this? We have a supposed witness to the events whose own testimony is copied from a non-witness. Is there anything more ludicrous than that? And the same holds up for Luke, who, although he's not one of the 12 disciples, nonetheless his testimony cannot be regarded as any sort of eyewitness statement because he borrows from Mark, non-witness. So we have a curious situation here that none of the testimonies are, in fact, eyewitness statements. Now, John, it comes into a class all of its own, and it has its own difficulties. I mean, the most telling thing and difficulty of John is that much of the reports given in the Synoptic Gospels regarding John do not appear in John's own Gospel. Now, the most striking thing here is the transfiguration on the mountaintop. Jesus, we're told, in the early point of his ministry, takes his favourite disciples, James, John and Peter, to a mountaintop, and there he transfigures into some glowing apparition and has the attendance of Elisha and Moses put in an appearance on the mountaintop, and then to complete the gathering, God himself appears and transmits a message from a cloud. Now, this is all by way of giving evidence to three humans, James, John and Peter, that he is in fact no mere mortal. Now, an extraordinary event, it obviously never actually occurred, but let's suppose it did occur. How could it be the case that when the Apostle John comes to write his gospel, his story of his encounters and his time spent with Jesus, he forgets to mention, he mentions not a single word of Jesus transfiguring on a mountaintop. I mean, hell, if that really happened, that would be not something you would forget to mention.
The synoptics mention John in incidents at least 20 times in their own Gospels, and yet none of them are recorded by John himself in his own Gospel.
These are just some of the problems of the Gospels, the documents on which the Christians base their faith. Despite everything you may have learned when you were a child, the truth is that scholars, even theologians, have no certain idea who wrote the Gospels. They have no clear idea when they were written, and they have no idea where they were written.
Well, I figured I'd start you off this morning, boys and girls, with a little bit of anti-religion. Yeah, from JesusNeverExisted.com. I'll be bringing you one of these little snippets about every day, I think, from now on, because if you can't escape the trap and slavery of religion, you're not going to save anything, I'll tell you that. Anyhow, this is Terrible Tom Metzger in the bunker right here, White Aryan Resistance, P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Send your snail mail and your donations for the radio show and other things. Donations for the POWs that are languishing away in prison. And they're really appreciated of that. I get letters from them that they've been able to purchase things in the commissary that they never could afford to do before. So we're making life a little bit easier for them. And they know, and also that makes them understand we're out here for them and like that. So anyhow. Now, this is Wednesday, and guess what we're going to do today? Like we did, I think, last Wednesday, we're going to do another Sling Blade show. And for the newcomers, these Sling Blade shows are from our archives of shows that our comrade Sling Blade has done over the last few years. And these particular tapes, unfortunately, don't have dates on them. So it's simply potpourri. I reach in there and pull one out. And so we're going to put one of those on pretty quick here. And we never know exactly what Sling Blade said on these tapes. I mean, he could have said, this old Tom Metzger, he ain't right. But anyhow, he does a great job, and I'm going to put Sling Blade on here and see what he's up to now. If some of the phone numbers or anything on here, on these tapes, forget them. They're not good numbers. And some of the stuff might be a little dated, but otherwise it's real good.
On the walls of bathroom stalls, make that. And the white man better wake up pretty soon here. I mean, you got Malik Shabazz outside of a Philadelphia courthouse yesterday. I hate crackers. I hate every iota of a cracker. I want to kill all crackers. Black man, you want freedom, you got to kill some crackers. You got to kill the white babies. Wow, that's the second guy to call for killing white babies behind Khalid Muhammad. Incidentally, yesterday, there was a Chicago police officer murdered in the parking lot of the precinct, the cop house. He just got off his shift. He's going to his car, and he got in a scuffle with somebody. I guess this black guy ambushed him and killed him with his own gun. Officer Thor Soderberg, was the third Chicago cop to be killed in 11 months. Now, I don't know about you guys. I still get pissed off at that. I know I'm not a friend of the police. Police don't like me. The FBI definitely doesn't like me. But I still get pissed off when I hear about white cops being killed by blacks. It just bothers me. There was two white cops killed in Tampa Bay last week by a black. So, at the risk of sounding like a broken record, I'm going to tell you again, the word is out about white people. The Muslims in Europe think white people are scared little bitches and cowards. The word is out amongst Mexicans down around the border and the drug cartel people that white people are cowards. And I really believe that this violence, this narco violence in Mexico, is being used for propaganda purposes for us to be afraid of Mexicans so we don't oppose them when they possibly get amnesty. There's a restaurant in Philadelphia. I guess it makes the best Philly cheesesteaks in the city. A guy by the name of Vento. I guess he was related to the guy who ran the Philadelphia outfit, the organized crime, back in the 70s or so. And he's been in business for 43 years now. And in Philadelphia, from what I understand, if your restaurant is going to be inspected, you get the notice, and then within the next 2 years, they'll come and inspect your facility to see if it's clean. because, you know, that's just how backed up the people are who do the inspecting. I think his name is Joey Vento. I think that's the guy who runs this restaurant, Gino's, in Philadelphia. I don't know where it is in Philly. He's received 4 inspections in a year. Totally unheard of. He's being harassed because he has an English-only policy. And now Mexicans, who have become very obnoxious and arrogant in this country because they have numbers, they keep saying on the news it's 10 million illegals. No, it's not. It is 30 to 40 million. They are lying to you. They become bold, arrogant. And like the Muslims in Europe, the word is out amongst Mexicans that we are a race of cowards and we will not defend anything. They look at the news. They see white people being victimized by blacks. And there's no outcry in the white community. We need to lose our fear of these people. We need to lose our fear of all these non-whites. And I don't know what's going to happen with these cops. Hopefully they'll wake up. But I'm not holding my breath. Your average street cop will probably has more of a chance of waking up than Zog agents for the FBI, ATF, and DEA. We're in some dangerous times. I was thinking today that maybe these shows that I do, the shows that Wall Street and DC and Computer Man do, the shows that Tom Metzger does, maybe it's not for this generation. Maybe it's for the next generation who's really going to have their ass handed to them. Not to say that nothing's not going to happen to this generation, because I believe all hell's going to break loose. And it's not going to be any, there's not going to be any consternation on the part of Bilderbergers and global elitists. You know, when Harry Truman, say what you want about the guy and all his many faults, you know, dropping the bombs on Japan when he didn't need to, being a lackey for the military-industrial complex and international Jews. When he stopped being the president of the United States, he went back to that little house in Missouri that he came from, that he owned as a young man, and lived there the rest of his life. Presidents now, I don't even know when this started. I think it started in the last 20 years. They become, it's like the presidency is a stepping stone to being a global diplomat. Bill Clinton, I think over the last couple of years, has made $100 million just on speaking engagements. And now he's just a global ambassador. I know it seems overwhelming to look at all of this. Even if we were doomed, no matter what we do, you should still have the mindset of destroying the system. Even if you knew deep in the back of your mind that you would never destroy it, you should still rebel against it. White man, if we're going to go out, let's not go out on our knees. Let's go out on our feet. Picking it up from the Handbook of Rebels and Outlaws by Mark Mirabello. Let's see why I highlighted this. Pseudo-conspiracy. A pseudo-conspiracy is a false group set up by secret police. It can have many functions, from ferreting out local dissidents to embarrassing a foreign government. A classic pseudo-conspiracy was the Trust, a false insurgent organization established by Felix Dzerzhinsky. I think we talked about that in the last show. the Soviet spy chief and master of counter-revolution and sabotage. Ostensibly, the trust appeared to be anti-communist organization, and it received money and assistance from the United States, the British Empire, and the Russian exile community. In reality, it was designed to control, destroy, and identify the enemies of the communist state. The trust enticed many Russian dissidents and some foreign agents to their deaths. Pseudo forces, still in the P's now. The use of pseudo forces. Units of foreign insurgents who have been turned has been a common feature of anti-guerrilla warfare since 1945. The Selous Scouts, S-E-L-O-U-S, who operated between 1973 and 1979 in the Rhodesian War, were a classic example of a pseudo-terror force composed of turned guerrillas, meaning, you know, they're not really turned, meaning they didn't really flip. They operated as intelligence gatherers for the Rhodesian state. The Selous Scouts, who never had... Well, I guess they appeared to be guerrillas to other guerrillas. I think I talked about this yesterday. The Selous Scouts, who never had more than 120 men in active service, operated in 8-man units. Dressed and armed like guerrillas, their function was to engage the enemy, but to report them to fire force teams or land units. For protection, all military activity was frozen in areas where the Selous Scouts were operating. The Selous Scouts also involved in waging a dirty war. For example, they committed atrocities that were blamed on real guerrillas, such as burning black villages and murdering white missionaries. To spread discord among the enemies of the Rhodesian state, the Selous Scouts also spread false rumors identifying real guerrillas as informants. All warfare is based on deception. See, you would never fall prey to this if you just recognize that when you are alone and on foot, you're a very hard enemy to defeat. Especially if you operate far from home and far from work and wear nondescript, uncharacteristic clothing. Trying to establish an office front like the Nazi Party did in the 60s, and I guess that was okay for the 60s, you know, it was a different time, different tactics for a different time, you know. I don't think those tactics are good now. For some white organization to get an office front somewhere, I think is really counterproductive. It's like a guerrilla army behind enemy lines trying to establish and control certain territory. You don't need to control any territory. You do the act, and the act is worth 1,000 pamphlets. So, what do I mean by act? Probably a Zog agent would ask me anything the people out there deem that to be. If their act is standing on a street corner with a lollipop singing "I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy," then that's their act. They have no commanding officer, no higher up authority to answer to. A lot of people will say, "Oh, the lone wolf thing will never work because there's no organization." Well, I don't think it really needs organization. I think people need to just get out there and get active. And I think you know by now what I mean by being active. Let's look at pseudo-provocation. In military terms, a pseudo-provocation is a clandestine or black operation in which perpetrators manufacture an offense to justify an overwhelming military response. When states invent the provocation, the easiest method is to attack their own territory, their own installations, or their allies in a way that it appears to have been carried out by the enemy. States conduct these operations to fool their own citizens and allies. The enemy, of course, knows he did not attack. At the start of World War II, Nazi Germany fabricated a Polish attack on a German radio station called Operation Canned Ham. The Germans used a fake incident to justify their assault on Poland. Yeah, I think they took prisoners in German prisons or whatever and put Polish uniforms on them or whatever. You know, a false flag operation. You know, the Gulf of Tonkin was a false flag operation to get us in Vietnam. Everyone knows now, it's pretty well accepted now that the Gulf of Tonkin incident never happened. That they were never fired on by the North Vietnamese or the Viet Cong. It was a lie. Okay, we maneuvered Japan into attacking us. You know, in December 1st, 1941, or the first week of December, or the last week of November of 1941, the Japanese embassy, I believe in Washington, D.C., was seen vacating the building and burning all their files in the courtyard. Everyone saw this. The State Department saw this. The White House was warned by the Dutch East Indies and Australia that a heavy Japanese fleet is moving into the area. The Japanese naval code was cracked 2 weeks prior to the attack. East wind rain was the code, meaning attack on the United States. You know? Roosevelt knew it was coming, but that they needed this Japanese. They need to provoke the Japanese into attacking so they can go to war against Germany. You all know this. World War II, or World War I, we went into there because, the German Jewish bankers told the British government that, hey, we can get America in this war on your side. Don't surrender to the Germans. Well, what led to that? The sinking of the Lusitania. Germany gave ample warnings in American newspapers that American ships were supporting the British war effort. That is a violation of international law, is a violation of our own constitution. You know, they purposely had that ship with all those passengers in heavy U-boat territory. And a German sunk it. And they had every right to. And now all of a sudden, the propaganda shift in America. You know, they had pictures of drawings of German soldiers stabbing Belgian babies and stuff like that. It was a false flag operation. Went to war against Spain, supposedly because of the attack on the USS Maine. Supposedly the Spanish off the Cuban coast or whatever fired on the USS Maine. And I guess used one of them floating explosive devices and tore a hole in the hull or something like that. The captain of the USS Maine said numerously, hey, this was not an attack. This was a malfunction in the boiler room. This had nothing to do with an attack. They told him to shut his mouth. That was the time when America turned imperialistic. We took Cuba away from Spain, and then we went into the Philippines, killed a bunch of Filipinos, and took the Philippines away from Spain. America the Empire was born. False flag operations through everywhere. 9/11 was a false flag operation. Let's read pseudo-terrorism. Oh, here we go. A type of false flag operation. A pseudo-terrorist act is a state-orchestrated atrocity disguised as a real terrorist attack. An alleged act of pseudo-terrorism was the Reichstag fire in Germany on February 27, 1933. The Nazi government blamed a young Dutch communist Jew named Marinus van der Lubbe, who confessed while in police custody. Well, probably coerced into confessing. Many believed, however, that the Nazis themselves ignited the fire. The incident allowed Hitler to invoke the Enabling Act that gave him dictatorial powers. In American history, some individuals believe that the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995 was orchestrated by the federal government. I don't believe that. To justify draconian legislation soon after the attack. Bill Clinton signed the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. Later came 60. The later added 60 new capital crimes, including large-scale drug trafficking. This technique of terrifying people into demanding the creation of a police state is called the strategy of tension by the Italians. Let's look at pseudo-threat. A pseudo-threat is a bogus menace created by the ruling elite to intimidate the gullible masses. We're nothing but scum to them. I hope you see that. On a pseudo-threat, authors of the report from Iron Mountain made this observation. The existence of an accepted external menace is essential to social cohesiveness as well as to the acceptance of political authority. The menace must be believable. It must be a magnitude consistent with the complexity of the society threatened. And it must appear at least to affect the entire society. War on terror. Right? Al-Qaeda. I believe a CIA-created boogeyman. Osama bin Laden. At Crawford Ranch right now drinking beers with George Bush. A clean-shaven hair guy with a fresh haircut wearing denim jeans. Was probably out on Crawford Ranch with George Bush riding horses. Come on, man. Are we that much of a fucking idiots not to see the connection? To see how close the Bushes are with the Bin Laden family? Did Henry Ford say history is bunk? Who know how much shit we read in history that's bullshit? Pseudo-weapons are false weapons used to bluff the enemy. In 1976, a Croatian terrorist hijacked an American airliner with a fake bomb made from a cooking pot, some ordinary wires, and some common putty, and some other items. The terrorist assembled a fake bomb on board after he passed through security. I don't know if that would pass today. Psychiatry. Let's see why I highlighted this. Psychiatry is a form of social control disguised as therapy. According to Thomas Zsasz, S-Z-A-S-Z, a modern critic, psychiatry represents a new form of the Inquisition. And psychiatrists are the new witch hunters. Dedicating to protecting the status quo, psychiatry used the insanity label to control dissidents, undesirables, and mavericks. Anyone who resists is drugged or institutionalized. Interestingly, yeah, I got a mouthful of marbles. Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, and William S. Burroughs Jr., three rebel writers, had all experienced mental hospitals and prisons by the age of 30. That is very interesting. I never really thought about, psychiatry in that way until I read this. That's somewhat illuminating. Racism comes in many forms. According to the Eskimo legend, women copulating with dogs produced the first white people. Women copulating with dogs produced the first white people. That must have been some pretty smart dogs to create skyscrapers and cars and trains and planes and automobiles. Let's look at what he has to say about Raid, not the roach killer. They attack just before dawn, believing that the sleeping man, maybe I should pick it up. All right, a raid is a sudden, unexpected, violent, destructive assault. The raiders always withdraw immediately after the raid was successful, whether the raid was successful or not. Commonly used in asymmetric warfare, the guerrilla raid involves stealthy movement, surprise attack, and swift dispersals. It's talking about the Native Americans here. They attacked just before dawn, believing that sleeping men had the greatest difficulty arousing themselves at the time. Well, the sentence before that I omitted says, Native American warriors were masters of the raid. The fuck out of here. American soldiers did the same thing. You know, English soldiers fighting the French in the Hundred Years' War did the same thing. It's not like they coined that tactic or whatever. So tired of it. I mean, you know, this guy gives, I mean, I'm not saying this guy's one of us, this Mark Mirabello. He's definitely not one of us, but we'll use his shit for our own good. Right? Recruitment of operatives. Innumerable techniques are used to identify and recruit operatives for an organization. To identify potential guerrilla fighters, the Viet Minh held rallies. Trained observers monitored the crowd for individuals who reacted positively to the message. The Soviet KGB, when recruiting terrorists, searched for individuals hurt by fate or nature, people defeated by unfavorable circumstances or the ugly. Such people, according to the Russians, make effective terrorists. Their terrorism gives them a sense of importance and makes them feel empowered. For the first time in their lives, they can feel superior to the prosperous and the handsome. When recruiting assets, espionage organizations such as the CIA use night crawlers. A night crawler is a talented spotter who prowls nightclubs, taverns, and so forth, looking for government employees, military personnel, and other people in strategic positions who can be compromised or blackmailed using drugs, alcohol, or sex. Under the heading of repentance, it says, on the subject of repentance, the Marquis de Sade wrote, nothing simpler. One repents only what one is not in a habit of doing. Frequently repeat what makes you remorseful and you will quickly have done with the business. Well, I mean, soldiers who went to combat testified that their first kill was shocking and internally disturbing. By the time their second and third and fourth kill got easier. Let's look at retreat. According to the author of Phantom Soldier, the Occident is conditioned to think that various armies move only forward. Occident meaning white. That's not true. In contrast, Oriental strategists believe that to intentionally limit one's freedom of movement makes no sense, for retreat can lead to victory. Yeah, okay. Read von Clausewitz. He says somewhat the same thing, but in a different vernacular. For example, under constant attack by Chiang Kai-shek, well-supplied army, Mao Zedong's forces retreated 6,000 miles from October 1934 to October 1935. The retreat cost thousands of lives, but Mao's movement survived. Whoopity-doo. Revolution in America. American Revolution. Strictly speaking, the so-called American Revolution, 1776 to 1783, was not, in fact, a revolution. Since 69% of the signers of the Declaration of Independence had held colonial office under Great Britain, historian Francis Jennings described the uprising as a barons' revolt. Huh. Is he trying to say that the American Revolution was really one group of rich guys going against another group of rich guys? Who had the most to lose for the most to gain? Was it the landowners? I'm reading a little bit of this book called Wealth and Democracy by Kevin Phillips. Not one of our people, but fucking I'm bored. And he starts with the American Revolution and shows you how power gravitates towards government, and government gravitates towards power in the form of wealth. What we're experiencing today is nothing new under the sun. The Gilded Age, the era post-Civil War to the early 1900s, I believe that's when the term robber barons was created. So, nothing new under the sun. It just need to rebel. Effects of revolution. According to Albert Camus, who is a French philosopher, very popular on American universities, by the way, in the 1960s. All modern revolutions have ended in a reinforcement of the power of the state. 1789 brings Napoleon. 1848, Napoleon III. 1917 brings Stalin. The Italian disturbances of the 20s, Mussolini. The Weimar Republic, Hitler. And according to Jose Ortega y Gasset, I know that name sounds spickish, but I think this is a white man. I'm almost positive this guy was a white man. The author of The Revolt of the Masses, a revolution does not last more than 15 years. No, a revolution can last 100 years. We need to make it transgenerational. I remember when I went to Nordic Fest in 2005, and there were a few kids there. I remember there was this one kid there. He had to be like maybe 8 years old. He had a camouflage t-shirt on, camouflage pants. Kid had a scowl on his face the whole weekend. I'm like, man, what the hell is he learning in his house? Hopefully he's going to grow up to be some pissed off Aryan warrior. Okay, workers and revolution. Mikhail Bakunin noticed that non-revolutionary nature of workers. Workers tend to have specific grievances, such as higher pay, fewer hours, and their demands can be satisfied within the existing social system. Workers seek reform, not revolution. Very enlightening. Very enlightening. We can preach about how white workers are being screwed over by the Mexicans. Would that be enough to fill our ranks? But then again, we don't want to fill our ranks in the form of an organization. An organization that can be easily infiltrated. We want activists to go act on their own. I would think it would be great if that was to happen, even with people who've never heard of resist.com. See, that's where I'm really hoping where it comes from. You know, I hope that there's people in the radio club out there who are not known by Zog. That Zog does not know who they are. I really hope that is true. And if you're not known by Zog, and use a pseudonym, email address, you don't, go to resist.com from your home computer. But a lot of you probably do. Saves on time, you're a busy guy, All right, in the same caption, workers in the revolution. Also by nature, workers are conservative. The grievances of the people look backward, not forward. Rather than demanding new rights, they complain of being deprived of ancient rights, real or imagined. According to Bakunin, authentic revolution can be made only by the politicized criminal class, bandits and brigands, in alliance with disaffected students, marginalized intellectuals and peasants. Huh. Interesting. Race ricin. Now, why did I highlight this? R-I-C-I-N. A deadly poison extracted from crushed castor beans. Ricin has no known antidote because ricin works so quickly. And because a minuscule dose is fatal, toxicologists will not readily recognize it in the victim's body. In the Soviet period, operatives used ricin to kill dissenters. One victim was Georgi Markov, a Belgian defector. In 1995, in the United States, four members of the white supremacist group called the Patriots Council were convicted of plotting to kill federal officials with ricin. The group planned to combine ricin with DMSO and place the mixture on doorknobs and steering wheels. DMSO, also called dimethyl sulfoxide. Dude, I sound like a total illiterate. Dimethyl sulfoxide. That's what it says. S-U-L-F-O-X-I-D-E. Sulfoxide. Never heard of it. Is a tissue solvent that can carry various substances through the skin into the bloodstream. All right. Human rights. The universe is a violent pageant of creation and destruction in which man has no special rights. In modern democratic states, certain persons, namely criminals, the mentally ill, the very young, and soldiers, are deprived of certain traditional rights. A soldier who abruptly quits, for example, will be hunted down and punished. Universe is a violent pageant of creation and destruction. We are witnessing the destruction of the white race, and I do not use that as hyperbole. We are literally seeing the death of our race. You got Obama and his administration wanting to sue Arizona. And Arizona's law, just to let you know, does not give cops the authority to just pull over a Hispanic-looking driver. That's not what it is. If the cop witnesses a Hispanic driver fly through a red light, he chases them down, pulls them over. It's after they've committed a crime they can check into their citizen status. You know, Eric Holder, who's a piece of fucking dog shit, you know, lets off these Black Panthers for the voter intimidation thing, but he wants to still pursue the Arizona thing. I mean, they are really accelerating things. I hope you guys see that. It is a planned, accelerative program. All right, speaking of riots, a bloody uprising of the poor. Riots are urban affairs. Generally speaking, they quickly degenerate into poor-on-poor violence. Riots are innumerable in history, but one famous American outburst was the New York City draft riot, which began July 13, 1863, and lasted for three more days. Fanned by racial hatred. That's right. These whites were like, why the hell should I go die for blacks? And as a result, over 600,000 whites went to their death for the Civil War. And by the way, the Civil War was not fought over slavery. Slavery became an issue 2 years into the war. It was tariffs. It was the South spending more money for goods coming in the country in the northern ports. The South was like, hey, we can have European goods come in our ports in Charleston and in New Orleans. You know, you guys are going to tax us more because these things got to come down south. And plus, according to this Wealth and Democracy, if I'm not mistaken, the Civil War was really a wealth grab by the North. You know, he pointed out that the South giving up their slaves, which believe it or not, was considered economic wealth. Giving up their slaves and, you know, I'm not sure how he worded it, but the result of the Civil War was most of the wealth of the South went into Northern banks at the end of that war. Think about that. All right, fanned by racial hatred because of the draft riots. The riot included the savage lynching of more than 88 blacks. The sight of mutilated corpses hanging from lampposts was common. Some were covered with oil and set ablaze, leaving charred skeletons. The rioters, after totally burning large sections of New York, including three police stations and the so-called Negro Orphanage, were crushed by federal troops called back from Gettysburg. According to some estimates, there were hundreds killed and thousands wounded. The New York City draft riot may have killed more federal citizens than many Civil War battles. Interesting. Robin Hood, the fabled medieval outlaw skilled with the longbow. The legendary Robin Hood was a Saxon who fled the Sherwood Forest to escape the tyranny of the Normans. Robin Hood gathered a band of hardy followers such as Little John and Friar Tuck, and they robbed rich Normans and gave the loot to poor Saxons. The Sheriff of Nottingham made endless attempts to capture Robin Hood and his band of merry men, but always in vain. You know, we're occupied, but the people who want a free America, who probably want a white America, outnumber those who don't, I think. I believe a lot of whites pay lip service to diversity and stuff like that, but I really believe that they really don't want that. You know? Okay, under rubbish, danger of rubbish. Remember, even in a so-called free society, your refuge has no privacy rights. Anything you discard may be used against you in a court of law. Under rumors, it says Sun Tzu knew that rumor was a weapon of war. While orchestrating a coup d'etat against Salvador Allende, who was president, or no, he was a dude, the dude, you know, Salvador Allende, the Marxist leader of a century-old democracy in Chile. The American CIA used media assets to report shortages of sugar, gasoline, toilet paper, and other consumer goods. The rumor was false, but people, out of fear, began hoarding, and this created a real shortage. Which rumors were believable? Which rumors were believable? According to the Russians, people rarely believe that which they greatly fear or greatly desire. You know, that whole thing in Chile that took place in the 70s, and Nixon was behind that. I read a book called The Trial of Henry Kissinger that Christopher Hitchens, who's not one of us, he talked about just the machinations of Kissinger and Nixon, the untold deaths that they caused, not only in Cambodia and Laos and East Timor, but in Chile. And it was because the top guy for Pepsi-Cola, I guess, you know, they had a big plant down in Chile. And I believe it was Allende said, you know what, I want some things for my people. I want better roads. I want this. I want to tax these Pepsi-Cola people, who's making millions of dollars. The plant is in his country. Remember, I believe in self-determination for all people. I don't want to see white-run American corporations going into the third world and abusing them. I hope they rise up and kill every one of those people and burn the plant down. I really do. But he wanted to tax the Pepsi-Cola people. I guess I read this also in Greg Palast, who's an exiled American reporter now reporting for the British newspaper The Guardian. He's exposed a lot of shit. He has a smart alecky kind of writing style, which is pretty comical. But he's not one of us. He likes black people a little bit too much. But he wrote a big piece on this in his book called The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. And he had a large section about this thing that happened in Chile. And it was all because this Allende guy wanted to get some money into the state treasury so he can do some things for his country. And the Pepsi guy, I forgot his name, went to Kissinger and said, hey, went to Nixon and said, hey, man, this guy wants to tax me. So what do they use? And American boobs always fall for this. Oh, there's a communist, you know. He was called a Marxist leader of a century-old democracy in Chile. He was called a Marxist. He wasn't a Marxist. He believed in the democratic rule. He just wanted to tax Pepsi-Cola, get some money for his people so he can better their lives a little bit. But in American TV and in the media, oh, he's a Marxist. He's a bloodthirsty Marxist. That's what they do over here. And I fell for a lot of that shit in the 80s, you know, about Daniel Ortega and Nicaragua. Oh, he's a filthy communist. And the Contras and the, you know, they're just the good guys, and the Sandinistas are evil. Well, looking back on it now, I'll bet you the so-called communist Sandinistas wanted self-determination, and the Contras were backed by America. You know, you look back on all of our history in the last 40 years, everything we did was for the advancement of big business and transnational corporations. You got to see that. I'm not making that up. I think I've read enough shit to come to that conclusion. Okay, so you can use rumors as a weapon of war. Remember that. Under Rwanda, I don't know why I highlighted this. Let's see what it says. In spite of assimilation, periodic massacres occurred in Rwanda. Yeah, I guess the Tutsi and the Hutu, they resemble, or they looked like the, I guess it was the Hutu were short and dark, and the Tutsi were tall and thin and more light brown, you know, when they first were introduced to each other, I guess. But then, you know, after a certain time of assimilation, they started looking similar to each other. But it says, in spite of assimilation, periodic massacres occurred in Rwanda. In 1994, approximately 800,000 Tutsi were bludgeoned or hacked to death over a period of 100 days. An estimated 1 in 50 Hutus participated in the killings. Those who protested were themselves killed, so most remained silent. As one observer noted, in 1994, the machete in Rwanda became a weapon of mass destruction. Let me tell you something, a white man can swing a machete just as good as any third worlder. Okay, under sabotage. It says, examples of cold sabotage include disabling a vehicle by placing sugar in a gasoline tank, pouring instant rice into the radiator, and placing glue inside ignition locks. Public utilities are especially vulnerable to cold sabotage. The system is heavily centralized by the vulnerabilities of the decentralized. The electrical grid, for example, has hundreds of thousands of miles of high-tension lines, and this grid may be compromised at any point. Terrorists may secretly remove bolts anchoring the power pole and escape. Days, even weeks later, the loosened bolts will cause the pole to topple in a storm. Since it requires 12 soldiers to guard 1 kilometer of infrastructure, protecting the entire grid from sabotage is impossible. impossible. Just like Metzger. Metzger is impossible. He just tries my patience, this guy. Let me tell you something about Tom Metzger. No. I don't know if I highlighted anything under Skull and Bones. How much time do I have left? The Order, which was called the Chapter 322, was once known as the Brotherhood of Death. And it's called Skull and Bones by those who make light of it. The Mystery Secret Society was founded in 1833 at Yale University by Huntington Russell, an opium trader, and Alfonso Taft, an ancestor to the president. He's an ancestor to President Taft, who came later. The emblem of the order is the death's head. Now, I've read somewhere that the SS, who used the death's head too, was a Masonic order. I read somewhere that the Allied forces were controlled by the Masons in World War II, and the Axis powers, with the exception of the Japanese, were controlled by the Masons. How is that possible? Why would they do that? No, don't say that about my Hitler. I've read that Hitler had a great-grandmother who was Jewish. I've read a number of sources that high Nazi-ranking officers were Jews. You know what? I'll save the Skull and Bones for later. I'm in the S's now. I still got 9 tapes or 8.5 tapes left. And the W section of this book is going to be pretty long. So many different variables of weapons, you know. I mean, and then there's the subject of war. I got a bunch of stuff highlighting that. And then weapons, cities and weapons, and defense against weapons, and countermeasures used by the Vietnamese, you know, what weapons they use. And just, I don't know, it just struck me as interesting. I hope you guys aren't bored by this. Just putting it out there, saving you guys some reading time, so you can spend more time in the streets. What are you doing in the streets? I don't know. I'm not your boss. You're not my boss. I only answer to the man in the mirror, and so do you. If you live life by being a law unto yourself and recognizing that the people who write your laws are utterly corrupt, the laws are written to keep the sheeple in line so we can be good taxpayers, so they could tax us even more for this bailout and that bailout. You want to continue being a slave? Then resist.com is not for you. If you're here because you're one of these guys that want to wear a uniform and a swastika, resist.com is not for you. You want to get Nazi-style tattoos? Resist.com is not for you. Time for you to keep your mouth shut about your views. If you're serious about true guerrilla activity, and I'll let you determine what that guerrilla activity is going to be. But we must secure the existence of our people and the future for white children. Carpe noctem, seize the night, starve the sheep inside you and feed the wolf, and make shield wall and wolf heart part of your mental makeup. Shield wall says, you will not feel compassion for your enemies who say, we just want to come over here and have a better life, and we just want to help our families. We just want to have, you know, do right by our children. Yeah, right. When they get in their big mobs and protest shit, they carry their Mexican flags and they grab their crotch and flip us off. Yeah, you're here just for that. Bullshit. Who knows how many people are listening to this? Maybe I'm just talking into the wind. I hope not. I hope not.
Well, that tape was marked. The date on that was from July 8th, 2010, 4 years ago. Incidentally, when Singblade mentioned about the money and how they took the money out of the South and put it in northern banks, let me tell you, in actuality, much of the southern money was already in northern banks even before the war started. The southern planters, and they also were marrying into banker families and so forth like that. So there's a lot of things about the Civil War that a little bit interesting. Well, I see Russia's richest man, Alisher Yuzmanov, has bought the auctioned Nobel Prize medal of publicly shunned racial American geneticist James Watson. He says he plans to return the medal to its owner. Asamanov's bid of $4.1 million won the medal at the auction. USM Holdings Group, of which the billionaire is the largest shareholder, said on Tuesday. In my opinion, a situation which an outstanding scientist sells a medal recognizes achievements is unacceptable. Yuzmanov said in a statement, Dr. Watson's work contributed to cancer research, the illness from which my father died. It is important for me that that money that I spent on this medal will go to supporting scientific research and the medal will stay with the person who deserved it. Unquote. The auction took place on December 4th at Christie's in New York City. The medal was awarded to Watson in 1962 before discovering the structure for discovering the structure of DNA. However, the scientist claims he was forced to auction off the prize after being ostracized for 7 years following his public comments about black African IQ in 2007, which were widely deemed racist. Yeah, it's racist, and we're proud of it. In October 2007, Watson told the Sunday Times in an interview that he was gloomy about the prospect of Africa because all our social policies are based on the fact that their intelligence is the same as ours, whereas all testing says not really, unquote. Since then, Watson has not been invited to give public lectures. Isn't that? Don't you hate these bastards? Quote, because I was an unperson, I was fired from the boards of companies, so I have no income apart from my academic income. He explained before auctioning off his Nobel Prize. Are you going to have sympathy with the people who do things like this to a person like this that did tremendous scientific work and is telling the truth about race? When the time comes, don't give me that shit about you're going to feel sorry for them. As far as I'm concerned, I do not care what happens to any of those kind of people. I don't care how they end up, whether it's violent death or otherwise. I could care less. Yuzmanov is worth $15.8 billion, according to Forbes magazine. He is also a major shareholder in Arsenal Football Club. The Sunday Times named him the second richest man in Britain in 2014. Well, I commend this. You hardly ever hear me condemn or say good things about a billionaire, but in this case, I'm sure going to do it. And I mean, it just drives me up the wall that the people are allowed to drive a person like this out of their job and out of their career when he was head and shoulders above anybody around him. So just remember this kind of stuff. When a time comes and these bastards, our opposition, plead for mercy, just remember this. Just remember this. It would be nice once in a while if one of these kind of people with all that money would have put a little bit into our struggle ourselves, because we've always operated on a shoestring. We've never needed billions or maybe even millions, but we could use the money. But the money will go to some of the flim-flam people on the right, but if you talk straight and go for the throat, you're not going to get any big money. And any time any group or guy, a person gets it, like National Alliance had it willed to them from the man in Canada, they'll come in there with 50 lawyers trying to take it away from you. And I don't think that what's left of the National Alliance is going to get hardly anything out of that thing. So I know I had one person that had me in the will years ago, but once she died, they moved in on her. Her relatives moved in on her and got her money and a whole bit, and fast-talking lawyers, and away they went. So that's the way it goes, boys and girls. But revolutions don't necessarily in the beginning have to be heavily funded, because the use of unconventional warfare can even up the score and encourage some of the fat cats to say, maybe we better get on the other side in this struggle. 14-5, and shut your mouth and don't let them in your house without a warrant. Don't go with them unless you're under arrest. Don't get in that interrogation room. They're going to tell you, say, well, we're not interested in you, but we think you know somebody we want to talk to you about. That's a trap. Never fall into it. And always plead the fifth in any grand jury situation where you're anywhere near being a target. And believe me, if they call you to a grand jury, you are one of the targets.